Welcome to another episode of the Gay Barchive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our special guest today is longtime activist and gay bar owner, Carla Kosho. So welcome to the show, Carla.
Why, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
I'm excited to hear about some of your stories from San Diego. I think the only segment we've done so far from San Diego was Chad Michaels. And he talked about his career there, but I think he comes into the picture a little bit later than some of your stories. You are a San Diego native.
Yes, I am.
So you're well familiar with it since your teen years with the kind of gay environment in San Diego and what it was like.
That's correct. I had a couple friends in high school, and we found a place called Jerry's Hole, and we used to go sneak in there, and that was our first spot.
And at that time, were there a lot of gay bars in San Diego?
I don't know how many there were, because we were probably 18, so that was the one we knew about and that we could get into. So then, after that, I had mainly gay male friends, and they would take me out with them. I didn't know really any lesbians for a while. And the ones I did meet were scary. And so they would sneak me into, as I said earlier, would be like a scrum. And we would push our way through the front door as a group and hide me in the middle because I didn't have an ID. So Brasbro was one place that we used to, Barbary Coast is an old place. It was, I think it had been a strip club previously. And then Ball Express was a place that was also kind of in the same area.
Yeah, I've heard of both of those actually. And you also mentioned Diablo, which when I first saw their ad, that when I first found their information a couple years ago, my first inclination was to think that it was a men's bar for some reason. I don't know if it was the name Diablo or the imagery, the kind of devilish, demonic imagery they used in their ads. But that was a women's bar, right? Diablo's was a women's bar.
Yes, it was definitely a women's bar. And then when I would ask my male friends to come there with me, they did not feel welcome. So that was a spot that I went to mainly by myself.
Was that normally the case in San Diego, do you think, with the women's bars? Were they generally exclusive of men at that time?
That one was. And when I got involved in Pride later and we did a national gathering, mainly what I was told that San Diego, the men and women seemed to work better together. But there was definitely places that men did not want women, and this was one that they did not want men.
Now, at that time, I know going back further, when you go back into the 50s and 60s, you find that in a lot of the women's bars, they were very label conscious. They were either femmes or butches, and there were kind of different crowds that went to different women's bars. But was that the case with Diablo's, or was it pretty integrated within the female community?
I remember a period of time where a lot of women wore three-piece suits, and I didn't really want to be subjected to the really aggressive women, so I went and got myself a three-piece suit, and there was very few women that were very feminine. So they would be very high in demand.
So after you got to kind of dip your toe in the water with Jerry's Hole and Barbary Coast and Ball Express and Diablo's, you also got somewhat involved in the Pride organization in San Diego, which is called Lambda Pride. How did that come about? How did you find yourself in the Pride organization?
It wasn't the first year, because I know that we marched in the first year, but there was a time that the socialists wanted to come and march. And they didn't really have a, you know, no, you can't. So there was a one person in particular that was very worried about us being kind of connected to them in any way. So they were going to cancel the parade. And so several of us that were younger and didn't really care decided Pride was too important. So suddenly there was kind of an influx of people who wanted to work on Pride. There's a guy named John Ciocio who was very important at Sandy, and he was also a member of that group.
And how long did you remain active with the Land of Pride organization?
I think that I was actively involved, like on the board. You were actually making phone calls and doing things, was maybe 3 or 4 years. But we'd also branched out and having festivals afterwards, and it wasn't just a Pride parade. It started to take on a life of its own.
Yeah, and I heard there was another bar in San Diego that played a big part in helping grow the Pride organization there, and that was WCPC, which now WCPC, was that mostly a men's bar that was somewhat mixed, or was it truly like 50-50 kind of?
No, it would have never been 50-50. I went there. That was one of my drinking holes, and to go dancing. But there was not a lot of women in there. Some
fag
hags, very few gay women.
Yeah, I had heard that it was owned by gay men, and I had heard that they got involved and kind of cleared their parking lot and, you know, gentrified the little area there so that Pride could be on safe ground, and, you know, helped nurture it and helped it grow. So
those guys are very open-handed with any organization in the community.
Now, if we fast forward to the early 80s, and it seems like you got involved at that point as an owner of probably the premier lesbian bar, women's bar in San Diego, which was called The Flame. Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
We like to say it was the best women's bar this side of the Mississippi. there was a lot of places where, like in LA, they would get a bar and start throwing a night, you know, once a week or whatever, but no one had a place you could go 7 days a week. There not that many of them, and to have a woman owner kind of made a different idea. So what I saw was so Diablo's closed down. There's a couple bars that men owned, straight men, and they kind of set it up to make it a lesbian bar. And that felt kind of creepy. So there was a bar in Palm Springs. God, I can't remember the name of it now. But it was really nice. And it was a gay man who I guess had been a designer. Flowers in the bathroom, nice glassware. So I wanted to have a place like that. And I knew the guys from West Coast. And I talked to them about it. I had also talked with another woman about doing it, but that didn't feel like it was going to work out. It didn't seem like it was going to be a good partnership. So I had found a location that, but I didn't have the funds. So I talked to Chris Shaw, and he brought in Walter Magnuson, who bought the building. And there was Tim Talent and Chris's partner, Doug Snyder. So it was me and the boys. And I had to fight for some things that they didn't understand. Like we needed to have more than two toilets in the women's room. Yeah.
Now,
so
the flame, from what I've seen of the pictures, it was not one of these bars, because in the early 80s was kind of an ambiguous time for any kind of gay, lesbian bars. But the flame was not hiding anywhere. It was on a street corner, correct? It was out in public. Yes. I mean, anybody could drive by and see that it was there. It was not hidden in an industrial zone with an entrance around the back and a gravel parking lot. This was in your face when you drove down the street. I mean, it was pretty prominent, correct?
Like South St. Louis, look for the red door. it was in the neighborhood, and you're right, everything else was in the industrial area, or, you know, there wasn't any people living around there. And so this was in our area, which felt safer, and it was, it had been a bar and a steakhouse and for a long, long time. We had a big, huge neon light on the roof, and we just went in and opened it up and painted it all light gray and put in carpet and a lot of pool tables and tried to make it lighter than a men's bar would be, because women like to look at each other. Men do, but we want to see each other and we want to be able to walk around. So we had a floor plan that allowed for that.
And how did the name come about? Where did the name The Flame come from?
It was the name.
So the steakhouse or?
Yes, it was actually, the area had the Egyptian theater and there was an Egyptian's apartment, and this had been the Garden of Allah. And from what I understand, it was like an early, early kind of strip club. And it burnt down, interestingly enough. And they rebuilt it and named it The Flame. And we couldn't really come up with a name. And we had the sign. So. And we were able to work off of that in our marketing quite a bit.
Well, I'm sure. And that's like, you know, people don't realize, but sometimes those things are just fortuitous, because, you know, it costs a lot of money to have a custom neon sign made and put up there, especially when you're just starting out in business. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of fortunate for you. How big was the space? How big was the flame?
It was 5,000 square feet. So it was huge, and it had a partial basement.
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know, all of our storage and everything, the offices were down there.
I don't think I've ever been to a women's bar, to a lesbian bar that was that big. That, you know, some of the men's bars were, but that seems really big for a lesbian bar.
I think our legal capacity was somewhere in the 300s. But we would have 1,700 people on Pride.
Wow. Did you have any outdoor space there? Did it have a patio or?
No. Mm-mm.
So everything was inside.
Yep.
And you already said you had a number of pool tables in there. Was there a dance floor and DJ and all that going on too? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. In the back part was the dance floor and a booth, and then there was a back bar back there, and it was a long bar when you walked in, and then the room next to it had the pool tables and seating, And then we had another room on the far end that was ended up being Cafe Spark, and they served coffee in there. And then it ended up being the Red Room later. And we tried to keep smoking going in that room as long as we could.
Well, because you didn't have any outdoor space to offer an option.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, people would go out and smoke and come back in.
Yeah. Now, when you decided to open this bar, I've heard you mention before in other interviews that an important part of this bar to you, that it was gay-owned for the gay community, for the women. What was there any competition at that time, any substantial competition in San Diego for the women's bar business? What other bars were open then?
Well, the bars that were open then was a small place in PB, which was owned by two women at one time. It was very small, one pool table, a block from the beach, you know, which some people really like that on like a Sunday afternoon.
Was that the apartment?
And there, yeah, the apartment. And then there was, I can't remember, she had had two bars, but Casey Corrado had a place that had been a men's go-go bar on India Street. And she changed the name. It Club Bombay. And then it was something else.
But they were both much smaller and much
smaller. And it was a different thing. It was more like if you wanted to get dressed up and go out with your friends and dance and that, then you would come to the Flame. Okay. If you wanted to go out with a couple friends after a softball game and have some beers and maybe play some pool, you would go to Club Bombay or Six Degrees. That's what they renamed it later. There had been another bar. It was another strip club that a guy had hired a woman to make it a woman's bar. It felt like it was almost like the Chinese bar, that they didn't do much to cater to women. It could have been any kind of a bar.
Right. They just basically put a sign outside that said, lesbians come in, and hope that would make it a lesbian bar. Now, you mentioned on the Flame when you took the space over and you painted the walls light gray and you put in some carpet and some pool tables.
And expanded the bathroom.
Did you have a men's room there, or was it strictly ladies' rooms?
No, we had a men's room, but we didn't expand it.
So when you first opened the bar and you had these other couple little bars around town, did it make a big difference in the community there? Did you suddenly see many more women coming out because there was more space for them and a new environment?
Yes. We had no idea where they came from. I mean, I've been going to bars in San Diego for a long time. And all of a sudden, all these beautiful women were coming out of nowhere. And that was something I thought was really important, besides having nice glassware and was having attractive women working there.
So your bar, from what it sounds like to me, and it kind of reminds me of one of my favorite old haunts from Atlanta, Georgia. There was a gay bar that I used to go to there that was called the Far Library. And the Far Library attracted kind of clean-cut, professional, businessmen types. You hardly ever saw anybody there in old blue jeans and T-shirts. It was always a golf shirt or a button-down, khakis and loafers. Very clean and proper kind of bar, very kind of professional and upscale. And that's kind of what the Flame sounds like to me. Like you would have had the aspiring women, you know, business women, and the clean cut, maybe, you know, collegiate types, and the somewhat older professional women that had their own businesses mm-hmm. or their own careers. It sounds like it was that kind of bar. Is that the case?
I would say on Saturday night, but we ended up having like older women, like 50 and up, that had their music and their own DJ on Sundays. And then we had a Hispanic night, a salsa night, and we had.
But these people would come other nights,
but that was their night.
So you were catering to your crowd, you know, and more than just one type of clientele. You're kind of expanding your horizons there. Did you serve food at all?
No, only at parties. We took the kitchen out because it had been a restaurant.
Right.
We ended up having a men's night, and it wasn't tried to be that. But then we had a DJ that kind of did, they call it new wave. And that brought all the boys in, and it got to be known internationally. People would come and say, I've heard about this in London or in Paris. And it would be crazy packed.
And how did that make you feel?
Oh, we loved it. The bartenders loved it because the men spent a lot of money and all of the women in there had good male friends, so it wasn't any of that weird stuff, and the women would come in too.
Now, when you first started this bar, you obviously did not go to college to run a bar or restaurant. You did not plan your life to be an owner of a lesbian bar. So you got into this bar scene, and obviously in the beginning years, I'm sure there was a lot of trial and error, a lot of learning and intuition saying, oh, I think this might work, and it kind of blossomed. But the bar remained open for 2 decades, for 20 years, which is an incredible lifespan for any gay, lesbian, or LGBT bar on the planet. Mm-hmm. What do you attribute that to? How is it that you managed to survive for 20 years with a bar that size?
Well, first of all, we had Chris Shaw, who had a very strong background in bars. And I had a really great belief that the woman would come. If they were given a place that was nice enough, that they wouldn't feel embarrassed to bring their friends in. Like I took my cousin to Diablo's, we walked in the door, and there's 4 women beating each other with pool cues. Well, it's not the best way to expose someone to your lifestyle. So people would bring in their mothers. My mother came to the flame. And, you know, it just felt better. We needed, a lot of women had a lot of chip on their shoulders at that time, and we needed to have somewhere that we feel like we deserve to have instead of the little hole in the walls. So I think that was kind of my driving force, really.
I can understand that 100%, because mm-hmm. I've made that statement numerous times before about the men's bars too, that mm-hmm. in the early days, my first bar experience, gay bar experience, was in the 70s, 1978. And
about the same time.
and most of the bars that I stumbled across at that point in the early, late 70s, early 80s, were, like I said, you know, rear entrance bars, painted over windows, almost no signage at all. Very dark and dingy, where you almost needed a flashlight to find your way through the bar. Mm-hmm. And they felt like, you know, you had done something wrong. It's like, you know, you're, mm-hmm. it's like your mother sent you to the children's table to have dinner or something. You're not good enough for the rest of the world. And when mm-hmm. we started to have bars, like what I mentioned with the Far Library, or what you're saying with the Flame, that were nicer and more proper, that had enough lighting that you could see your surroundings. You know, they felt clean. People were dressed nicely and behaved properly. You felt like you had arrived, like, because people don't realize at that time in the early 80s, if you were gay, you did not necessarily feel like a whole person, because you were not able to be gay everywhere you went. You had to, separate that life. And at work, you were kind of ashamed to be gay because you didn't want to be picked on by your coworkers or fired by your employer. You couldn't be gay in your apartment community because you might lose your apartment. You didn't want to be gay in front of your family when you went to Thanksgiving dinner because they might throw you out as well. So to at least have a proper space like that bar to go into and feel like, yes, I've earned this. I'm a real person. I don't have to, crawl under the boardwalk and look for the third cardboard box on the left to get a drink. I actually have a proper place. That makes a big impact on a community.
To go back to something you said earlier, I spent a lot of time in gay bars, starting when I was 17, 18. And we opened this when I was just turning 29 or 30. So I spent a lot of time looking in bars, sitting on bar stools, telling everybody what they were doing wrong, and knowing that I could do it better if only I had the chance.
And apparently you did. To make it last 20 years like that. And by the end, you mentioned that in the beginning, you had like four male partners in the bar, people that were already in the gay bar business and familiar with the community, but that you had partners in the bar. But by the time you got closer to the end of your period there at the bar, you were the sole owner. So obviously it was successful, and it allowed you the opportunity to reinvest that money back into, buying the business and having it as your own child. So that says a lot too. What made you decide to close the bar in 2004 when you closed down? Was there a reason for that?
There was a couple of reasons. The whole thing was change. The younger girls, they refill every year with 20 years. And, there's a gay bar around the corner from where I live, and my friend is from out of town, and she wanted to go there, and I said, everybody's 20, 35 tops. We'll look like creepers if we go in there. So, they were less and less of them coming in because they didn't feel like they had to go to gay bars. They could go somewhere else because they liked the music better. Or something. So we weren't getting the amount of people. And I was getting close to a certain age.
29.
And I always said I did not want to be an old dyke sitting at the front door with a flashlight with a big belt buckle that said Carla. And I didn't want to be that one. And it was time for me to do something else. And I realized that it was a success. And what could I do if I put myself out in the world? So that was kind of that was part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the world has changed a lot. And, I know you're aware of this because of the time frame. But back in the 80s and 90s, the gay bars were very much a part of organizing our community. They were they were like the glue that held us together, because that's where we could hold our meetings. That's where we could meet like-minded people. That's where we could meet partners that we were going to engage in a relationship with. Because we couldn't do that, at the mall or walking down the street in most cities. The bars were our community centers. They were everything to what made us a gay community the way we are today.
Right.
And as you mentioned, that's kind of changed now that we've gotten into the 21st century, which in my opinion is a little bit unfortunate, because I know for me, and I suspect for you, going out to a gay bar for the first time was, it made you feel like you belonged to a community. You had people that you could share your ideas with and talk about, you know, the things that were on your mind that you weren't going to find elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And I think they're missing that now. I think, you know, mm-hmm. even though they
can don't know what it's like, that part where you couldn't be yourself anywhere, but in right. the bar.
I mean, they can go to Applebee's and have a drink with their girlfriend if they want, but they're not going to become part of an Applebee's community, I don't think, the way we did, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Unless they work there.
So, yeah. So I kind of miss that.
Lisa. My first experience at the bar was The Flame when I was 25, and it just felt like home.
I lived only a couple blocks from The Flame. It had a huge dance floor. It had a huge cruising area, which women do cruise each other, believe it or not. It just had everything that I could even imagine to have for a women's bar.
I decided to run a women's bar because the women's bars that were around at that time were owned by men. What made The Flame special is that it was light and everything was brand new in there. I made a point of hiring pretty women. I like pretty women. I wanted it to be a place that people could feel comfortable bringing in their mom. My mother loved to go in there.
My best memory would probably be singing at The Flame for the open mic. It was my very first open mic in San Diego. That experience lit a fire in my belly to go, okay, well, maybe my dream of putting music out will be able to affect people in a positive way.
Particularly in the 90s, when lesbians were kind of provocative to straight men, we had to be a lot more protective of our clients in there.
I do hear stories of women feeling not welcome in the men's bars. That is definitely something that women experience, and unfortunately our transgender community is experiencing that.
I don't know about you girls, gals, but I feel uncomfortable even walking into a straight place sometimes. Mm-hmm. I can't hold my girlfriend's hand or know if it's okay. You know, even today, you really don't know if you're going to be a victim, you know, of discrimination or bigotry.
Part of the reason why our bars have kind of suffered over the years, mm-hmm. when we get together, we kind of cocoon at home, and yeah. we only yes. want to go out once yeah, in a yeah, while.
Yeah. Men make more money than women, and two men are making better money than two women, so, yeah. and that's the unfortunate aspect of it. Men go out more than women do.
I found jobs by going to the women's bars. I found partners. I made lifelong friends. You know, I could walk into a bar in Fresno or San Francisco or Denver, and if there was a women's bar there, I always felt at home and safe. And even today, I'll still seek them out.
San Diego bars is a history, but it's not always just about the alcohol. It's a springboard to launch you into the community or wherever you want to go. And then from there, you can touch other people. So again, it's like a ripple in the water.
What's at the heart of a gay bar? What I knew it to be was community, but I think it's a place to meet your friends and to meet new friends. I think that's really what it's about.
Here's to all those courageous women and men who actually supported women's bars.
So when you decided to close down the bar, did you attempt to sell it as a bar, like as a women's bar? Or did you just decide to sell the building and let the next owner do what they want with it?
The only way really was to sell both, because otherwise I would have been holding paper for somebody, and a lot of bars don't make it.
Oh, okay. Know? So they had to buy the
liquor license. 20 years is huge.
So they had to buy the liquor license, obviously, with it. Not necessarily yes. to be a women's bar, but to be a bar of
no. And it depended on two. Who was interested in buying it. And there was a guy that owned two other bars, and he was interested in buying it.
And so it still operates as a bar today?
No. There were three different people that tried to make it a men's bar, and there just isn't that call for it, particularly in the men's community, because there's so much online stuff. You don't need to go to a bar to meet somebody.
This is true.
You just swipe right or left. and that kind of killed it. And then somebody was allowing impeded people to sell drugs. They didn't like that, the alcohol beverage control people. So they were losing their license. So a guy that owns the apartments next door bought it and made it into luxury apartments, which is kind of cool. It's because it still looks very similar. He's really into keeping the look of things and not tearing it down and start on it all over. So it's still got the sign. It still looks pretty similar.
Oh, very cool.
And I understand they have a little supper club or bar maybe downstairs.
Very cool. Yeah, I did have a cool look. I'm going to put up a picture of what the bar looked like in this interview so people can kind of see the outside a little bit. But it did have a cool kind of retro look to it that just kind of makes you smile, especially knowing that it's in a little beach town. Well, little beach town, a big beach town like San Diego. It's kind of funny. Having never been to San Diego, in my mind's eye, San Diego was always like this small, you know, little Southern California town. And and when I started looking into it, as I was doing research on these different bars around the country, there's like, what, 1.5 million people that live in the city of San Diego now? I mean, it's a big
couple million.
And like 3 or 4 million that live in the county. It's a big place.
It's big.
So now you sold the business and moved on. And now you have your own real estate company.
I have found that I am not a corporate girl, or do I work well for other people. So I worked for somebody else for a while and then got my broker's license. And then I had an office for a little while. And now I'm kind of myself and assistant. And it works really well for me. I can still go on vacation. And I have built a new community and that I'm involved in. And I don't feel like I have to make, you know, I don't need to be a top producer. That kind of has gone out of me. And then I'm kind of thinking, what's my next stage? What am I going to do next?
What do you think that's going to be?
Right now I'm taking some painting classes.
I've actually seen one of your paintings, I think on your Facebook page or something.
Oh, one of my friends. I gave one of my friends.
Yeah, you gave one to one of your friends, and she posted a picture of it, and I thought,
it's the first time that anything's been posted, because I didn't think anything was good enough. But she loves that one.
That's very cool. Artwork is you know, one of those things that it just depends on how it speaks to people. I mean, if you look at the scope of art across the world, you have artists like, you know, Kandinsky, which is a bunch of splattered spots on the floor. You have Mark Rothko, which is rectangular, you know, shapes in various colors. You have Lichtenstein, which is very kind of comic strippy almost. You have, you know, Picasso, which, depending on what year you're looking at, you're not really sure what it is. You have Monet, which looks like you have just really bad vision and a lot of his paintings. So it's all a matter of how it speaks to you and what you know, what you interact with. And if you're passionate about it, you know, that can be a fun career, and it's something you can certainly do on vacation. You don't have a time frame, so I hope that works out for you.
Yeah, it's been fun. I've taken some classes, you know, and I have a friend who's very involved in it also, so it's nice to have a partner in crime.
And are you involved at all with any of the organizations in the gay community there now, or is that pretty much just a social thing?
Yeah, it's mainly social. I think I've done a lot of that, and the last organization I got involved with, I just realized that I don't know if I have the bandwidth anymore.
Right.
You know, I'd be glad to support, like, politically. I'm sending out money,
Uh-huh.
Because that's what I can do.
Mm-hmm. And go to the fundraisers and go to the banquets once in a while and,
right,
you know, support the silent auctions, which is all part of it too. I mean, everybody can't be on the board of directors or on the steering committee, but, mm-hmm, but we're glad to know that you've been out there for all these years supporting the gay community one way or the other, helping get, you know, Pride established in San Diego, building an incredible women's bar that lasted 20 years. And we need more people like you in the community. So thank you so much for taking the time to tell us about some of the bars in San Diego from your past and about your own bar, The Flame, which that must just warm your heart to know how many people were impacted by that bar and how it affected the local community. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. People still bring it up.
I know how it is. When I started this project, it started because of one bar in Atlanta called Backstreet, which was open for 30 years, a giant nightclub, disco kind of place. And they've been closed now for 15 years. They closed about the same time you did, or actually a little bit longer than 15 years. And their Facebook group to this day has like 11,000 active members.
Oh my God.
That still talk about it. And it's been closed for over 15 years. So when you make an impact like that, when you do something good for the community and they feel special about it and, you know, like you cared about them, mm-hmm, that's a legacy that lasts. And you certainly have made that impact on the San Diego scene. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Art.
That concludes another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show. For more information about this episode or to find more episodes, visit GayBarArchives.com.